Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
I just remembered that someone had to drive us to Toowoomba because Dad was too emotional to drive, and I remember crying the whole way up and then being given sedatives once I got to Grandma's because I hadn't slept. I didn't really believe it. I think I just went into shock.
Crime happened to a girl my age in my hometown in the late 1980s. It's the kind of story that sticks with you as you grow up and she doesn't. And in this case, the fact that it's still unsolved casts a shadow over the entire town, as it's likely that people in the community know what happened but are still afraid to speak for fear of reprisals.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
In December 2017, the Queensland coroner announced that the 1991 inquest into the murder of 15-year-old Annette Mason would be reopened. The crime shocked our community because Annette was living a life that seemed pretty unremarkable when compared to lots of girls her age in our town. We'll talk about the lives we were living at 15 later in this podcast, and I'm sure it will shock some listeners, particularly those who are fully grown adults still living with their parents. Peter Hardwick has covered every development in this case for local newspaper The Toowoomba Chronicle.
The main investigating police officer was Brian Ty, and I've done stories with Brian. He's retired now, and he was always, he said that a lot of cops leave retiring and they say that's the one case I wanted to fix, and it's the one thing that he wanted to fix up was that one and solve that one. He had suspects. He wanted to run a trial, put these guys on trial, but his superiors at the time said there isn't enough evidence, and if we don't get them now, if we don't get them at trial, they'll never be tried again. And so that was, and I know that frustrated Brian, but he just said, put it in front of a jury, let them decide. But the police were afraid that if they were the guys, they might walk. But
so what do we know about the last night of Annette's life? We know that she was out to meet with friends. She didn't get drunk. There was no alcohol in her system.
No.
But she went home very late, and also we know that her housemates were away, so she was to be alone in the house.
That's right, and she was walking home. She was seen walking home at one side. She was seen to get in a cab first, then she was seen walking. Then there is a witness that says he sees a man with her or someone chasing her or something like that at one stage. She mustn't have been far from her home when they intervened because she's found in the house. In her home, so they must have, obviously she was at home, or the killer or killers knew where she lived because that's where she's been found.
Was she sexually assaulted?
Well, it's never come out that she was.
Okay.
The police have never said that she was, whether that's something that they've been hanging on to. I don't know, but after all these years, I don't think they should be hanging on to anything. Surely, whatever happened, this inquest, hopefully, I'd love to see them name persons of interest. There are persons of interest, there's no doubt about that, because the police have given us names. And one of those persons of interest has rung me, so I know he knows he's a person of interest.
What did he ring you to say?
Oh, he was complaining that his name was mentioned in a report during a perjury trial in Brisbane, and it was related to the Annette Mason murder. And it was done in Brisbane, and we ran the story. And he rang me from the coast complaining that his name had been put out there and all this sort of stuff, and he was carrying on, swearing and carrying on. And I said, mate, I'm quite happy to do a story with you if you want to, protest your innocence and things like that. And he just said, I'll think about it. I've never heard back from him, and that's a couple of years ago now. But he knows that he's one of the names that's been mentioned. Ironically, as he said to me, he said, I've got children, Well, Annette never got a chance to have children.
Mm.
and you know she'd probably be a grandmother by now. Yeah, so they know, and there's another, I know one of the three that I was told is dead. Another one is getting on, and I believe he's just been released from prison. And the third, the guy that rang me, has been in. I've covered some of his trials over the years. He has been in and out of prison. He's been a violent man in the past.
Is the suggestion that the three of them work together, or are they separate?
No, the suggestion is the three were there together.
Right.
That's the line I was told by one of the investigating officers, and they're as frustrated as anything too.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to people who know what happened,
mm-hmm.
and for them to say something. I know that there was a woman at the time. I was told by one of the investigating officers years ago, he said there's a woman at the centre of it, and he said that she lived in Harlaxton, and she knew what happened, but she's in such fear that she won't say anything. Now, she moved in a state, but I would have thought the coroner could summons her to appear. I imagine he would, but I was told that she holds the key. And if she speaks, we'll get somewhere. And that's what it takes. It really takes people to be brave now. It's a long time to be living in fear. You know, you got to think at the end of the day, there's a young teenage girl who's murdered,
mm-hmm.
and brutally murdered. What a horrifying way to go. And she's got family here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I talk to her sister often, and it's just, you know, it's taken over her life, and it's still hard on them, but she's as brave as anyone, Linda Mason. She's really pushed for this inquest, and hopefully for her sake and for Annette's sake, that these people will come forward and say something.
I visited Annette's big sister Linda in her home in southeast Queensland, and I'll play our chat for you shortly. But first, I wanted to give you some details that I felt uncomfortable discussing with Linda. The initial inquest into Annette's case heard that she had died from brutal head injuries, believed to have been inflicted in or near her home in the early hours of November 19, 1989. She was seen getting into a taxi in Toowoomba's CBD at around 3:30 that morning. A witness came forward to report having seen a young woman matching Annette's appearance being chased by a man near her home at around 4:15 a.m. At around 2 p.m. that afternoon, a friend found Annette's body under a doona in her bed. There had been no forced entry into the home. The first inquest could not identify a person responsible for Annette's death due to insufficient evidence. But since then, there have been numerous hearings held by Queensland's Corruption and Crime Commission that helped narrow the list of persons of interest. A $250,000 reward remains on offer for anyone with information that could lead to a conviction for Annette's death. After the break, I talk with Linda Mason about the shockingly difficult process of resurrecting an inquest. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Linda Mason talks about what happens to your life when you finally allow yourself to grieve. But first, how does an inquest come about?
We petitioned the Attorney General for the last 2 years to get the inquest.
Mm-hmm.
It was denied twice, and the third time she actually sent a car to come and get me to tell me that it was approved, and I just broke down. So we worked so hard towards that was the first goal, was to get the inquest, and now that we have the inquest, the next goal is let's make this count. So let's get a conviction at the end of it, because we're using the laws. I think it's from 1958, because it was under that jurisdiction back then, so we've still got to go by those laws. And under that, the coroner has the authority to send somebody up.
So are you saying that you have to abide by the laws that were in place at the time of the crime?
Correct.
Wow, I had no idea about that.
Now they've all changed, and we can't go by those rules, whereas the 1958 Act, it means that the witnesses don't have to speak, but now they do, so they're compelled to give evidence now, whereas in under the act we're using, they don't.
Okay, so that's what you're still hamstrung by to a certain extent. So the inquest can call witnesses and they can refuse to come or just sit there and not speak?
Correct. So just, they can just sit there and not speak.
So when is the inquest?
I haven't got a set date yet. That will happen at the end of this month. We'll get a set date.
That you'll get the date. And what sort of waiting period then do you expect after that? Will it be this year?
Yeah, so okay. I'm hoping that it'll be before mid-year. It'll start.
Quite a quick turnaround, hopefully, yeah. after you're given a date.
Yes, it's been nearly a year since the Attorney-General approved the inquest. So, and it was to be finalised before the end of last year. So, yeah, it'll be quick.
Is there anyone that you know of that will be called to testify? Do you guys know of any people or persons of interest in the case?
No, I don't really know of any persons of interest in the case, personally, no.
But do you know their names? Have you...
Yeah, we've got a list. We're gathering a list.
Wow.
Yeah.
Who do you gather that with? When you say we, who is we?
So we've got a solicitor in Toowoomba.
And police? I mean, are you working with police on this, or is this just your responsibility?
This is now our responsibility. So the police have taken a step back now.
Wow. So who does the investigating to come up with this list?
That would be the lawyers and my barrister.
Yeah. Wow. So the choice of that barrister and that law firm's really important.
Yes.
I'm going to Toowoomba tomorrow, and I haven't been in about 5 years, and I've just been saying to people that when you leave a place that you grew up, it's in your mind it's always the same, isn't it? And then you go back and it's startling and sort of upsetting in a way, and you know, sad, you miss stuff. So what do you remember of Toowoomba at the time that Annette was living there in the house?
I never saw the house. So me and Annette had moved down to Dad's a few months before that, and I got a job, but Annette wanted to go back to Toowoomba, so I was going to follow her. So I didn't actually see that she'd moved out or anything.
So how old were you?
I was 17. I guess back then it was a different time. I remember going to the nightclubs trying to get into the powerhouse and rumours at that stage.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, me too, yeah.
But, it was a different time. It was like it was more... free, I guess, for the young girls there.
And also it was still a time when a lot of girls left school after year 10.
Correct.
And got jobs and got on with their adult lives, which today seems insane.
Yeah.
But it was definitely an option then, and I knew a lot of girls who took it.
Yeah.
And Annette was one.
And I was one, so I left year 10.
Yeah, right.
After year 10, so... Yeah.
So what did you do with yourself? Because so many of our listeners will be going, that's crazy. But so you're like 15, 16, left school. What did you do?
I worked at a cafe in Toowoomba there.
Yeah.
And then I went down to Dad and started working in construction.
Yeah,
so,
great.
No, actually, I tell a lie. So I went and did a pre-vocational course as a mechanic.
Ah.
And was offered an apprenticeship, but the money was so crap back then that I was like, no, when I could have got... like five times the amount to do construction.
Yeah, right, great.
So.
Yeah, so you just got on with your adult life.
Yes.
And started, you know, having money, which the rest of us back at school were so jealous of. Because suddenly you were the girls who were like, had nice clothes and jewellery and had your charm bracelets and saving for your cars and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it great?
It was good. But the thing I remember mostly about Toowoomba, I guess, is my grandparents' houses and the red dirt.
So your parents were broken up. You went to your dad's.
Mm-hmm.
Also, around this time, your mum got a job at the Goldie, didn't she?
Yes.
At the Gold Coast.
Yes.
So she was going there, and I read that she was very, very worried about leaving Annette behind.
Yeah, mum and Annette were always really close. And I think just at that time, Annette was hitting a rebellious stage. So she wanted to be out on her own and do the things that other teenagers were doing, even though the girls that she was with are a bit older than her, so they were around my age. And so she wanted to fit into these groups where she could act a bit more mature than she actually was.
Didn't we all? Yeah. So she said, I'm staying in Toowoomba. This is where my friends are. This is where my life is. I've left school anyway. So,
yeah.
And she moved into a share house.
Yeah. So Mum wanted to live with Grandma because Grandma was in Toowoomba, but Annette and Grandma were fighting at the time. So she said no, but this share house was just across the road from where Annette was working. So she was working at Philo at Clifford Gardens there.
Yeah.
And the house was directly across the road. And Mum said that she went and asked the neighbours and talked to the girls that lived there and talked to people that knew the girls. And they all said that it was fine and you know, they were lovely. And so, yeah, she, under duress, I think, she let her stay there with the proviso that she'd call Mum and that every weekend Mum would pick her up.
Oh, your mum was going to drive back to Toowoomba every weekend and
She was actually meant to come and pick her up that weekend, but Annette had called her during the week to tell her she was going camping with some other people, and these are trusted friends that she was going camping with, so Mum allowed that, but plans changed and she didn't go, so the guys went camping without her and she was left there. Yeah.
So what happened then that you know?
Well, from what I know, she was with the girls in the house and they all were going out to the Norval Hotel drinking, and then they went to a party. And this was more for, I think this was a footy club doing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, right.
It was a lot of older footy players. And
okay, so like a barbecue kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think she went back to the pub then and she had a few drinks until it closed and then she went home in a taxi.
Do you know if she was very drunk or...?
She had... There was no alcohol in the system.
Wow.
No, so
she was just out and about being social and having fun.
She was meant to be meeting people, so everywhere she'd show up to meet people, they wouldn't show. And then she'd go to the next place to meet the next person and they wouldn't show. So all of her girlfriends would say, like, meet me at one, and she'd go there at one. And, yeah, it was just... circumstances were just not going her way that night, so she ended up going home in a taxi alone. As far as we know, she made it into the house, and we don't quite know what happened after that, but she wasn't found until 2 p.m. the next day.
By who?
By one of the girls that lived there. Her friend had come to drop some shoes off, yeah, and found her.
The friend did?
Yeah.
Wow. So so you were in Brisbane with your dad, was it?
No, Nowra, New South Wales.
Oh, okay, long way away.
Yeah.
When did you find out what had happened?
It was a few hours after she was found. So my uncle went to identify her and then he called us. And Dad just kind of dropped the phone and I picked it up and said, you know, what's going on? And it was weird because that day me and Dad, well, and my brother, we were all wearing black. And we went down to the hotel for lunch. It was a Sunday. We had Sunday lunch down at the pub. And we're all wearing black and someone said to us, whose funeral are you going to? And we didn't realise until that afternoon that, you know, she was already gone. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I just remember that someone had to drive us to Toowoomba because Dad was too emotional to drive. And I remember crying the whole way up. And then being given sedatives once I got to Grandma's because I hadn't slept. I didn't really believe it. I think I just went into shock. And I don't think I wanted to believe it. I don't think I grieved at all until maybe 2 years ago. So
wow.
Whenever Annette was mentioned, I'd just leave the room. I just couldn't face it, I guess.
Wow.
Until Dad asked me to do this because he wanted to see some resolution before he goes. Once he asked me, I said yes, and then it kind of, I had to actually start feeling. It was really difficult decision, but, you know, once I start something, I won't stop until I get what I want pretty much.
Yeah. Can you remember those first days back in Toowoomba?
It was all a blur. I remember that they were going to see Annette, and I said I wanted to go because I wanted to make sure it was here. And then I had some sedatives, and I was asleep, and they all, my dad went to see her. And when I woke up, I found out they'd already been, and I was really upset. I'm like, it's not here, I just want to make sure. And they took me separately, and I got to see her.
Wow.
But basically, it didn't really look like her at all, because I guess she'd had the autopsy at that stage, and, you know, she was just like a piece of meat lying there. It's not really the way I wanted to remember her.
How do you remember her? How do you remember your little sister?
I remember her as being really shy. She's like a little lamb. She used to just follow me around. But, yeah, really, really shy, quiet, and, you know, she was everyone's favourite, you know. We'd go to the grandparents and she was the favourite, and I used to get a bit jealous because I was the middle child, so I have middle child syndrome, and Annette was the youngest for quite a number of years before Kevin came along. But whenever it was her birthday, there'd always seem to be family there, and they'd all give her gifts, and my birthday come, no one died, nothing. But, yeah, and she, I always remember she always looked up to me, like she was always wanted to be with me and my friends, and I don't know, she was just, even everyone at school just said, you know, she was so quiet, she was studious, she always excelled at everything. So she was always winning awards, and, yeah.
And her school photo that was used and in the paper and stuff at the time really struck me, because she just looked like all of us.
Mm.
You know, we all looked the same, of course, as exactly. Kids at that age do. We all had the same hairdo and the same freckles across our nose, and being roughly around the same age as her, yeah, I thought, God, she just looks like me or anyone. And we were all going to the same places, and we were all doing the same stuff.
Yeah, so I think that photo was like 2 years before she died, and the last 2 years she did mature a lot, and she did look older than her 15 years.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, inside she was still 15.
Mm. So how did you, do you remember when you left Toowoomba again? Do you remember, I mean, those horrible first days, and then what? Then what did you do? Did you go back to Nowra with your dad and back to work?
No, I think I did for a little while, and I left and went back to Toowoomba. I remember living in Toowoomba with mum until I was up there when my brother was killed, which was 6 months after Annette.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's terrible. How was he killed?
He was killed in a car accident going out to Oki.
Oh, no.
So I remember the police coming to my door because mum was away that weekend, and they showed up to tell me that he had been involved in a fatal accident, and I didn't know what fatal meant. So I just said, oh, so which hospital is he at? And they said, oh, you don't understand, he's dead. And I just went, I couldn't fathom that within 6 months I'd lost my two closest siblings, basically. And then I had to go around to grandma's and tell her about that. So we did. We stayed in Toowoomba for a while and got through, well, didn't really get through that, but, we had to, you know, stay for the funeral and everything, and then I moved back down to Dad.
How did the investigation seem to be going in the early days?
I didn't really have much to do with it. It was that mum was, she was main contact back then. So from what I understand, the original investigator, it was his first homicide.
Right.
So I don't know if, you know, he covered all bases or if he had somebody to lean on to talk to about what he should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know if there was, you know, gaps made back then. And I think he knows himself that there was stuff that was left out.
Are you still in touch with him?
Yeah, I still talk to him and Brian Ty. So they were the two original investigators. And Brian, to this day, he's retired. He still comes to every meeting I have. He wants to see justice just as much as I do. Mm. It's always haunted him. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't know what they should be doing in the best. I just wish, you know, we'd know, Dan, what we know today with DNA and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Because back then it was, you know, a blood type. It was no DNA evidence.
Yeah. Was there DNA to be tested then? Was there, do you know anything about that?
I don't know. I haven't seen any DNA results or any of the things that were ever tested. I know that about a year ago the police had said that they sent some more stuff for forensic testing.
Okay.
But I don't know what came out of it. Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, when does a case like this start to feel unsolved? When does it transition for the family from, okay, the police are investigating, to is this ever going to get resolved?
I think even after the first few years, you know, you expect something like this to be over quickly. You expect within the first few months to a year that someone's going to be, you know, held accountable. And once it gets over 2 years and then 5 and then after 10, it's like, oh, you know, what's going to happen? But then you read cases of 50-year-old cases that have come and they've been solved. So I don't know. I just don't know personally how much longer we could have held out. It was just starting to get cruel, like really cruel.
After 28 years?
Yeah.
Absolutely. So how did you talk to your kids about Annette when you were finally ready to do that? How do you tell your children what happened to their auntie?
I think they were nearly adults when I finally, you know, when it all came about. And before then I would say to my oldest daughter, you know, you remind me of Annette, you look like Annette. But she didn't really understand what happened. I didn't really go into any details until this whole thing came about, the whole justice campaign, and they were actively involved, you know, coming along to our parades and walks through the city. And
Did they know that their auntie had been murdered? Or did they just know that she had died and it wasn't to be spoken about, do you think, as younger kids?
I think the second thing. So I think they knew that Annette was their auntie, but they didn't know how she died or didn't ask, or it was a no subject.
It's amazing how this can happen in families, that you just know not to ask things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Judging by how upset mum gets if it comes up or whatever.
Yeah.
Wow. So when you told them, I mean, what was their reaction? It's unbelievable, as unbelievable as it was for you when you first heard the news. It must have been unbelievable for them too.
Yes, that's right. And I remember travelling to Toowoomba and showing them the grave, and that was the first time I'd really ever been. And I broke down, and I think they could see how upset that, you know, it makes me. So then I kind of think that that's when they copped on that. This is really something really devastating that happened.
Also, Toowoomba was a very small town at that stage, so that seemed unbelievable as well, that there could be so much mystery around this, didn't it? It was like, but everyone knows everyone. Everyone gossips. Everyone knows everything that's going on.
Yeah, and that's crazy. That's the crazy thing is, whenever a name is mentioned regarding who Annette knew in that last week of her life, because that's when she moved into the house a week before this happened, the people she met, I'd never heard of. And I'm like, how is that possible in Toowoomba? I knew pretty much everyone.
Mm.
And, you know, they said, "What? Who is this person?" I'm like, I don't know. I've never heard of them. And this whole crowd that I knew nothing about had come into her life. And that makes me sad to know that, you know, the people she spent the last week of her life with as people that I didn't know. And so I couldn't, you know, help. I know I always curse myself because I think to this day that if I was around, nothing would have happened to her. I would have protected her with my life, and I wouldn't have, you know, she wouldn't have been alone.
Yeah, but she would have been alone at some time. Because you're individuals, and, you know, I know that, you know, again, intellectually.
Yes.
this is not your fault or anyone's fault apart from the perpetrators.
Exactly.
But I can understand there must be guilt around that. Mm. I can't imagine how your mum has felt over the years. Yeah, and the flatmates, the housemates even.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've spoken to them all and they all feel the same. You know, they felt deeply saddened that, you know, something happened to someone so close to, you know, it could have been any one of them that was in that house that night. And it happened to be Annette. So, and I know Mum, she feels guilt, she feels a lot of guilt over it. And I said to her, you know, there's no one to blame except the person that did this.
Yeah.
People need to stop victim shaming.
Absolutely.
We're the victims in this. We didn't do anything wrong.
No, and neither did Annette.
No.
No, there's one person at fault.
Correct.
God, I hope they figure out who it was and is. How are your parents, how have they coped over the years with this? It's extraordinary.
I don't think anyone has. I think once this happened, our family kind of just split up and it was never the same. So Christmases were never the same, and you know, we never met up for birthdays. I actually moved over to Ireland a year after that.
Wow.
And stayed over there for 7 or 8 years, and we all just went our separate ways and tried to do the best we could.
Did you tell anyone that you met in Ireland about Annette?
No. When I brought it out on Facebook, when this campaign started, nobody even knew.
How long ago? That's 2 years ago.
2 years.
Wow.
And there's so many people were commenting saying, I never knew this about you. Because I was always the goose, I guess. I was always the joker, having fun, and covered up a lot.
Wow.
No one, not even the closest people to me knew.
So where did you get support?
I didn't. I get support now from my dad, and I'll talk to him. But I didn't really have a support network when it all kicked off.
Mm.
And I didn't plan on it being so hard. I guess I didn't plan on the feelings and everything coming forward and the whole grieving process. I didn't plan for that, and that came as a shock, and it really affected my whole life at that time. You know, I had to drop back work, and I wasn't sleeping, I was having nightmares, and I wasn't coping real well.
So, we know that the word closure is stupid, or it doesn't really, you know,
it doesn't exist.
No, and it can't bring it back. But do you think it will make a big difference to you personally if you know who's responsible and you see them pay a penalty?
Yes. So I think it will make a difference to me if I can see somebody. You know, I can't really. I know it's a whole justice campaign. I know that justice is that they serve time. I'm just kind of split because I see so much injustice on not only Annette but everywhere at the moment that I'm just so worried that I get a tap on the hand and, you know, this person meant everything to me, and if this slips again, I don't know. Like, I know that I will cope and we'll move forward if something happens, but if it doesn't, that's what I'm scared of.
Yeah. Wouldn't blame me, because you've made a decision 2 years ago to walk through this that you've been putting off for 28 years. I can understand why you'd be fearful about it not leading anywhere.
Yeah, I think this is kind of a last-ditch effort for the whole family. And that pressure, you know, I feel because I put on myself as well. It's like, you know, sometimes I think, what if nothing comes out of it? You know, not that I've wasted 2 years, because I would never think of it like that, but I just don't know how I'll cope. I think it's going to take a terrible toll if, you know, we don't get justice now, or if we don't get somebody convicted.
Mm.
this person could be walking around the streets. You know, how many other people have they taunted, you know, abused? You know, at the start, the inquest was put off because it wasn't in public's interest. And I just went, well, why wouldn't it be? You know, this person is on the street still. How is that not in the public interest?
Yeah, that's bizarre.
But, she's self-sense. And she said she knew I wasn't going to give up. So I said from the start, I'll do whatever it takes to get closure for, well, as close as closure we can get in this life. But, yes.
And life goes on, and now you're a grandma.
That's it.
That is so wonderful.
Little grandbaby.
Yeah. Does that feel wonderful? I mean, after the 2 years you've had, to have a baby in the family?
It does. Like, she's so cute. And, it's nice to have a little bub again.
Yeah.
In the family.
Yeah, you've got a beautiful family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I love my family.
I mean, that... is actually putting a lump in my throat that, like, through all of your denial that you've is the way that you've coped, would that be fair to say?
Yes.
For a long time, you've still managed to create such a quite a big loving family. That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
How have you done that?
I think it's because of the denial. So I think that the blocking it out, you know, it could have gone two ways. I could have been a drug addict on the streets and I'd have every right to be that.
Yeah.
But I decided that I didn't want that for myself, that I knew I wanted, not long after that, I wanted a family. And I wanted somebody to love again because I'd lost the closest people to me. Mm. And I wanted close people again, I guess. So that's the whole family.
It's incredibly gutsy to... fill your life with people you love again after you've lost them.
Yes.
People so close to you. You're a brave woman. You are undeniably a very brave chick. Thank you so much.
No problem.
I'll let you go. Love your family.
Honestly, Linda is the kind of person that keeps me passionate about this podcast. Someone said to me recently, oh, I know you've got a fascination with murder. And I said, you know what, I've got a fascination with the way people cope with extraordinary circumstances. As long as people like Linda want to talk about their experiences, I want to give them a place to do that. Thank you to Linda Mason and to Peter Hardwick from the Toowoomba Chronicle. We'll share updates on the inquest on our Facebook page, and you can also follow the Justice for Annette Mason Facebook page. Thank you for downloading this podcast. We'll be back with another episode next Thursday.